Hello and welcome to the We All Succeed podcast, a podcast dedicated to business strategy and helping the everyday person with the everyday struggles of business. We're going to dial into the trenches with an expert here today, an expert of information technology, an expert in artificial intelligence, and an expert in helping governments improve their processes through technology. We have Kodran Arseni. Kodran, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me on the podcast today.
I'm really excited to have you here. We've got a lot of amazing stuff going on. And before we begin with anything, I want to make sure that we take a moment to talk about emerging technologies. I want to make sure that we talk about this crazy thing happening with 2025. I want to make sure that we talk about the future of technology. But before we begin with any of that, there's something going on in Congress right now in regards to artificial intelligence and that whole at a federal level. Can you dial into that and help us out? What's going on there?
Yeah, of course. So this week, the U.S. Congress is holding hearings focusing on the Defense Department's progress on artificial intelligence initiatives, which is a very critical technology area that many of our elected officials are very concerned about. Concerned about artificial intelligence, but also emerging technologies, given the fact that China is also making a lot of headway with their own artificial intelligence initiatives. And unlike our government, China has already released its next generation artificial intelligence development plan with a very clear goal of becoming the world leader in AI. By 2030. So what's happening this week in Congress is definitely just a little bit reactionary to what China is doing, but also something that is really critical for us as a nation to really start this conversation about AI, automation, predictive analytics, and how all of these emerging technologies can actually impact the everyday life of all of us living in this country.
So, Kodran, but you just said impact the everyday life. That's huge, right? This is a huge, huge topic, and it does talk about emerging technologies. And I want to make sure that all the listeners and everybody who listens to this podcast, I want to make sure that everybody's on the same page. Why is that so impactful, not just in the AI area, but across emerging technologies? Is this a lot of precedent-setting stuff, or...?
No. So the reality is that artificial intelligence, even if in specific areas, has not necessarily evolved to a place where it can, you know, like take over the world, like the Terminator idea. It has evolved enough that it can impact how governments are doing business, how governments like the U.S. government is actually streamlining its own caseload, safety protocols, cybersecurity, the taxation process, and a lot more. So this is the right time to have a very meaningful conversation, and a conversation that should be about the initiatives that the U.S. government should engage with, but also about regulation, because artificial intelligence is not regulated within the current legal framework in the United States. I mean, just I'll give you a very simple example, which is telemedicine. You know, telemedicine is an emerging technology currently leveraged by more than 35 million Americans on an annual basis. It's at the bottom of technological advancements. I have nothing against telemedicine. In fact, I think it's a great idea. I'm just saying from a pure impact perspective, it's kind of at the bottom of, being able to roll out this initiative, to roll out this technology. So it shouldn't have too many different impediments. That said, the majority of the U.S. states have not passed any regulation allowing for telemedicine to happen. So when you have something so benign out there that is struggling to really become a technology en masse, imagine what's happening when it comes on to bigger, more serious, more dangerous topics such as artificial intelligence. It's like off the bat, it will become very difficult for us as a nation to really tap into the potential of AI, blockchain, predictive analytics. And the reality is that we're having a conversation at a national level, we're having a conversation in Congress, but my bigger fear is that despite all of these conversations, progress will be rather limited. When China is doing the same, here's what's going to happen. The Chinese president set up this priority and everybody's going to execute against it. But in the United States, that just cannot happen, right?
Right.
Whether it's Trump, Obama, or any future president, the reality is that the powers of the president are limited. The powers of Congress are limited. So in many ways, our government can only go as far as to recommend certain technologies, but to actually implement them, that becomes a day-to-day struggle from a pure implementation point of view.
That's very, very interesting. And this definitely showcases why this is an area that we cannot lag behind on as a country, especially if we've got other people who are definitely taking a strong, firm hand and initiative to make it a huge effort in areas like information technologies in general, AI being a huge, huge trend-setting one. So we've got China. You mentioned China. China has got a lot of stuff going on. They've released a lot of things recently, the China 2025 being a major, major topic. Is this part of that initiative or is that a separate initiative?
No. So China 2025 originally was announced as a platform, as a philosophy, and as a initiative back in 2015. And for a while, not a lot was going on. But for the last year, things have really picked up significantly. So what is China 2025? It's ultimately the Chinese government's initiative to compete at a global scale in the field of high-end technology. So right now, the way we think of China, for the most part, is that's where our clothes are coming from. That's where the toys are coming from. That's mm-hmm. how garlic is coming from. Majority of the garlic imports in the United States come from China. So it's these manufacturing activities that are defining, by and large, our perception of China. And traditionally, for the longest time, the United States was the powerhouse in technologies of any kind. And we are, at the end of the day, more often than not, we are a service country. That's where money is coming from, right? I live in Chicago. It's one of the most powerful service cities in the nation and most populous. So that's what we specialize in. So what China is doing now, saying, I'm going to compete with the United States, where most of the money is. What China is doing right now is really lifting itself out of the current execution of really just basically being a manufacturer and a distributor of services. And what it's trying to do in 2018 and then beyond is to become a service provider, and not just any type of service provider, but a service provider for some of the most important services at a global stage. So what China 2025 ultimately does is it identifies 10 key sectors where China wants to become the number one. And unlike, at any time in history, now these 10 sectors are in direct competition with the United States. So some include becoming one of the biggest provider of chips and computers and cloud services, robotics, flight technologies, railway technologies, smart green cars, renewable energies, but also drugs and devices. So we have one of the biggest device manufacturing industry in the world here in the United States. Healthcare on its own is the largest private employer in the United States of any industries. So now you have China coming in and saying, I want to become the number one drug and device manufacturer in the world. And I have set up specific guidelines where these number of drugs should be approved by the FDA in the United States. So it's a clear step forward towards competing with the United States at a scale that we've never seen before. And that's fine, because ultimately competition is a core value for the United States.
Right.
What is not fine is that we are not approaching what China is doing correctly. So what we've seen under the Trump administration has not been nothing more than a demonization of what China is doing. Everybody within the government is talking about China as being a threat, that someone who needs to be stopped from its initiatives. Like, A, nobody's going to stop China. And B, yes, it is a threat. But how you approach that threat is what defines what we're going to actually accomplish over the next 10 to 20 to 50 to 100 years. And my argument is that we're approaching this the incorrect way, which is basically to just blame China for what it's doing versus actually trying to compete in the same space. So,
okay. So I want to jump in here for a moment, because I heard a lot of important, powerful things. Right. We heard that at a very, very high level, China is very heavily getting involved in pretty much everything that has helped us be a successful country. Right. All the major service industries that people are purchasing from us. This is a major effect to our infrastructure, and totally that the response is kind of an us versus them mentality of, well, let's just blame them. And kind of verbally attack them for this. And that's that, you know, we agree that that is definitely the wrong way to go about anything, especially if you want to have large amounts of success. And you have a lot of conversation. I know this is one of the things that you're an expert in, especially when it comes to governments, is how you optimize processes using information technology, using artificial intelligence, using these major pieces. But that seems a bit far away from somebody who's maybe at a local government office to be able to really directly affect. Definitely at a high level, it seems really huge. How is this impacting, let's say, Chicago, or how is this impacting local municipalities as well?
Yeah, so Chicago, under Rahm Emanuel, has actually been one of the cities leading the change for digital transformation and adoption of emerging technologies. I mean, personally, I have a lot of things I can say about Rahm Emanuel that we're not necessarily on the same page. But when it comes down to technology, what he has been doing has definitely been on the right track. And he has been the leader in moving Chicago towards becoming one of the most interconnected smart cities in the country. And that initiative will, if it pans out, right, he's stepping down and a new mayor will be elected shortly. But that initiative would put Chicago in very direct, meaningful competition with some of the initiatives happening overseas. So I'm actually very proud about that, about everything that has been going on with connected cities in Chicago. But the reality and the biggest fear I have is that it's too little, and even if we just started competing with other government, it's too little too late. And here's the bottom line. Here's the real crux of the problem at hand. Even if a specific local municipality would like to use emerging technologies to streamline processes, they are not in a position where they can really impact the outcome without getting alignment from other different centers of power. So some of the things that I didn't know before Digital Authority Partners actually started doing government business is that, let's give a specific example. You go to Cook County or to any county, and you want to roll out a digital initiative. Well, you have the chairman and the board, but you also have all of these different independent entities that have power to block your initiatives. So if you want to do, for example, a new streamlined system of paying your taxes online across property taxes, government taxes, and everything in between, where you just want to transact with the government, you're thinking of it as being the city of Chicago, but behind closed doors, the way this has been structured is that you have a comptroller, you have a circuit, a local circuit, you have all of these different departments. And you know what the problem is? That they're all independent. So if you want to actually do one thing right that would impact citizens across the payment interaction with it, you may not be able to do it at all. Because of internal politics, you may not be able to do it because one specific government agent says no, and there's nothing you can do about it. And that's what it is. And nobody's ever going to find out, right? Like we had one of these situations recently where not in Cook County, but one of the other counties where we work with the local circuit. I honestly don't remember exactly what the terminology is, but that the person in charge of the judiciary system, who is a public publicly elected official, he just said no, and there's nothing that particular county could do to push the conversation forward. So you have, at its crux, you know, it's very counterintuitive. The biggest problem to adopting technology en masse at scale in the United States, that we have too much democracy. That's what it is. China has no democracy when it comes to
it is,
this.
Yes. And, it is very hard to convince the nation founded on democracy to have less democracy.
So, right, and that's not an argument I'm trying to make.
Absolutely. I just want to be I want to make sure that all of our listeners are aware we're all pro-democracy. Where's the win? How do we adjust this? How do we make this happen? Because this is a big issue. We never want innovation in any way, shape, or form to be stifled, because that doesn't just affect, you know, big overarching things. It affects small things like whether or not we have things like garlic in our houses. It affects, you know, micro things as well for us. So how do we – do we have to make an adjustment? What do we have to do in order to make this a win?
So first of all, we can start with an example, a government example where they did the right thing, and it's NASA. So NASA is subcontracting a lot of its work to Elon Musk and to SpaceX. And it's doing so because private contractors like SpaceX are better equipped to solve a problem that the government is facing. And they're in a better position to do this more cheaply than the U.S. government would do it. So it's not a, you know, just a win versus lose. We can see this thing here at home where some government organizations have done the right thing, and they've partnered up with the right folks who can actually make this happen. But the bigger problem is not going to be fixed, right? From everything I see in dealing with local, municipal, federal government is that there's so much politics that will prevent specific initiatives from occurring. And what that means is this: we need a more powerful local or federal elected officials who can actually take this battle into the public forum. Because people are able to say, hey, I don't want to do anything in AI behind closed doors. But if you have a senator, or if you have any charismatic leader that takes it upon themselves to really militate, to take one cause forward, that's really, within a democratic society, the best we can do. We need these champions. We need better officials who understand exactly what technology can do and who will be there to really fight for it. And the problem is we don't have it, right? Like, we've seen this, and it was such an embarrassing moment at a national scale. When Zuckerberg, the Facebook CEO, went to Congress for his hearings to see the maturity of the questions and, you know, let's call them the lack of technological expertise that our public officials had, that was a very frightening moment.
Yeah.
Because how do you really bring change from a pure technological point of view to government when our elected officials could barely understand how Facebook works?
It is true that it is the number one trending thing today. The number one trending search thing on Google was 100% related to a governmental official not understanding how Google works. That's the number one trending. It's like, you can go to Google Trends, and it was somebody asking a question about how it could be possible that a governmental official would be attached to the word idiot. and they're like, it's based on searches, not based on, you know, somebody who's just behind the screen deciding these things. So it's very interesting that these kind of things are happening. And as if I recall, it has been an active conversation at both the increasing the technology level of our cities, increasing the technology of our governmental officials at a national level. I think it was you actually who was telling me that Obama had put something in place previously during his administration.
That is correct. So President Obama, who I want to say out of politics, just talk specifically who he was as a person. He had the expertise to really understand how technology can impact our life for the better. So he actually published a new policy and backed it up with funding to help municipalities become smart cities, which is to leverage technology to improve the current governmental processes that are impacting government, impacting the relationship citizens have with their government. And I think it's about $160 million in funding set aside for this. But also, he really, came up with remain in my memory, which is a quote which said, like, I want us to ask ourselves every day, how are we using technology to make a real difference in people's lives? Mm. That's what his goal was with this initiative. You know, of course, where we are today is a different story altogether.
Sure.
But yeah, I mean, the reality is that even if we cannot come up with a policy that will really compete with China, there's so many different things that can be done and so many specific ideas that can be implemented to really improve the overall relationship between governments and citizens. And some agencies, to their credit, are doing it. So, for example, the Department of Homeland Security, they launched Emma, which is a chatbot developed for the U.S. Citizen and Immigration Services Department. And this simple chatbot, which is a piece of very rudimentary artificial intelligence, can help people on a wide variety of requests tied to their immigration services. It's small, but it's meaningful, right? Right now, I think there's more than 1 million people leveraging Emma on a monthly basis. And there's a lot of local governments that are also experimenting with voice search, voice technologies. I think it's the Mississippi State Department launched a chatbot where residents can really get any information about how the state is interacting, the different decisions, etc. So that's a cool thing. And then City of LA also launched a voice-enabled application called LA City. So we're seeing some of these different technologies being implemented at a local level in very localized ways. So that is, they're very contained. Because they're contained, different officials can actually go get away with developing them and with launching them, which is great. But what I want to see is a more holistic take that the U.S. government puts forward in order to fundamentally redefine how different processes are being implemented. So I think the best way I like to give examples, for people to understand. So just think about this, AI in the context of caseloads. So throughout the government, there's so many backlogs of different types. There are cases, there are requests, there are applications that we make, for a permit, for, being in a different zone or whatever it is. Like at a local level, there's so many requests that just come in on a daily basis. And that takes literally millions of people to go and say yes or no. So one of the simplest ways to actually use automation and to use artificial intelligence is to deploy a solution that will very simply answer yes and approve all of the permits that are clean cut. Like, you're always going to approve these permits. And that would right now there's over 10 million requests in a queue that are being added every single day. Well, just imagine, if you have 10 million times a day when a human in government doesn't have to just go there and say yes, how much time you would be saving.
Oh yeah, I mean it's clearly a no-brainer thought when you look at things and you ask the common person whether or not they believe that their government is efficient, and they say no, not really so much, and we say, well, we have a way that we could fix that or improve it. Everybody gets excited. It's just one of those things that people love the idea that maybe they don't have to wait at the DMV forever. And we see a lot of that kind of stuff getting implemented, or anything where it's something, you know, emergency, but still clear cut, whether it's business or not, whether it's business or personal. Somebody might have a child support thing, or somebody in a business might be looking for a very important permit or something that allows them and requires them to do the work that they need to do. Now, what I love is this isn't just a topic that you love talking about. This is a thing that you deal with on a daily basis. You are the CEO of Digital Authority Partners, and these kind of governmental implementations, this whole methodology of what you're talking about, it works, and you do that on a day-to-day basis. Now, here on We All Succeed, we actually like to do a deep dive, and it doesn't have to go too deep, but we want to understand that process, know what it looks like, know how somebody would reach out to you, or do you have to reach out to the governmental place, or let's just say the mayor of any city, any state. Any governmental officials want to reach out and figure out how they could do this. How would that happen? How would that work? Walk me through that.
Yeah, of course. So we, in order to really interact with various local governments, we put together a process that helps any single government official get in touch with us. And they can get in touch with us, not necessarily to say, hey, I have an RFP, and I would like you guys to bid on it, which that's totally fine as well. But what we've noticed is that there's so many government officials who want to do something with artificial intelligence, and they don't know where to start. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that we have operationalized is the ability for us to come at any any municipality in the world for a one-day workshop, and that's a discovery workshop. And we do this at no cost to the local municipalities. And just think of it as being a threats, opportunities, challenges exercise, where we talk to government officials. We understand what their problems are. We understand the biggest challenges. And we come back and say, based on everything we've heard, there's these 4 or 5 initiatives you should consider doing right away. So we're not a cookie cutter agency. Mm-hmm. Our approach is to really listen, but also moderate the conversation so we understand exactly how to help different organizations. And in addition to that, and I would love to talk about this, we are currently actively developing a solution.
Yeah.
For citizen communications and engagement, based on all the things we've seen and heard from both the government point of view and also from the citizens' point of view. But just to finalize the discussion, like, how does this work? So people reach out to us, we have conversations, we understand their pain points, we do a one-day workshop or half-a-day workshop around specific themes, and then we come up with solutions. That's one way. The second thing that people can do is we can be brought in as consultants for 1 week. So we follow the Google design sprinting process. Mm-hmm. And what that is, the Google Sprint, it's a methodology and a philosophy that Google basically brought forward. There's a lot of books about this that you can look up online. And what that does is we bring all of the different executives, all of the different people who are interested in making a difference at a municipal, government, federal level. We bring them all and we kind of have them sequestered in a room for 5 days. Mm-hmm. Day one, we identify a specific problem. Day two, we take them through a variety of exercises that would help them define all of the different ways that particular problem can be fixed. Day three, we all together define different ideas on how we can execute it from a technical point of view. And not just from a technical point of view, but from a user experience point of view. Day four, we create a prototype that's fully functioning. And day five, we actually put this prototype in front of 10, 15, 20 users. And we collect that feedback, in a specific location where everybody who was a participant can see exactly if people are excited or not about it. And that has been
Wow.
very it's been very revealing, especially in the government space where you're not used to getting feedback. You're not used to having a resident from your own backyard basically come in and says, "Well, this app sucks. This idea sucks. I will never download it." Or, "This is great, but there's these four things you did poorly." Or, "I need this not to be an app at all." Like, we had a case. We have a we had a design sprint recently, and we express our reservations from day one that a mobile app is not necessarily the right way to go, but those people wanted to pursue the idea. We did everything. We got to Friday, and on Friday everybody was saying, like, I don't need an app. Can I just make it an Alexa skill? Can I just basically go and ask Alexa about this specific context with this specific issue? That would be a lot more helpful." So that's very revealing. Because the reality, and I don't know how much your listeners know about how government business happens, how it's done, but it's not done in a way that you get to say what, how things should be done. So, in other words, let's say a local, let's say city of Chicago decides they want to do one thing, and then they put an RFP out there, and then a bunch of companies will bid for that RFP, and then sometimes the company that gets the contract is the one that has the strongest and most powerful lobbyist. Other times you get lucky. Other times you don't get the contract because you don't, especially at the federal level. At the federal level, there's these regulations and rules about, like, you need to have a minority status, or literally, and I'm telling you, literally, you have to have this many women, you have to have this many people of color. It's a question that we are asked all the time, like, how many African Americans do you have? Which is a precondition to applying for a technological project.
Interesting.
Has nothing to do with whether we can do it or not. The question is, do you have minority status? And sometimes we have to, go around and partner up. Sometimes we work with companies that have done business with the government in the past that will be nothing more than a pass-through, because if we don't go through that company, we get disqualified. So you see how there's all of these different structural impediments that are in place.
That is actually very useful. Our listener base is primarily business owners and usually the CEO or COO or vice president of a company. So that's actually very helpful for a lot of people understanding, a lot of the listeners understanding a lot of the context and also how they engage with those governmental contracts. Now, you also said, and you said, and I don't want this to disappear because you did actually secretly mention amidst everything we're talking about that you had a program. Something that you were developing to help with this communication process. And I didn't really get full clarity on what exactly that was, but I'm very, very interested.
Yeah, absolutely. So, as I mentioned, we're doing business with different government agents and municipalities. And w the biggest problem that everybody who is a publicly elected official have, what they want to know is, am I doing the right thing? There's no, like, in the public sphere, everybody's demonizing everybody else. It's like it's all about the political discourse. But behind closed doors, public officials, they really want to know, like, am I doing the right thing? And how are our constituents reacting to the things that we're doing? So in that context, we came up with the idea of creating a citizen communication platform. So right now, the code name is Citizen Connect. It's not live yet. It's something that we're actively working on. We're now in user testing. And what that means is we're putting this in front of real users, asking them for feedback. And what Citizen Connect is, the way we're envisioning it, is the ultimate community application. No matter where you live in the United States, you should be able to download one application which is going to give you all of the local news, a forum and a platform where you can interact with other people in your community, other residents, a platform where you can interact with your government officials, but also a way to figure out where you have to go to accomplish a variety of tasks in relation to your government. So pay taxes, pay your fines, lodge a complaint against a specific institution. So we want to bring all of that together into one platform, which is called Citizen Connect. So for example, as part of our research, we've realized that there's literally thousands of Facebook groups which are dedicated to a neighborhood. And only people who live in that neighborhood can get on the group. So we want to bring that in the context of the mobile application that we're creating. And it's not just about, you know, interacting with residents. It's about overall hyper-personal and relevant recommendations for you as a member of a community. And those have to do with how you interact with the government, but also how you interact with other people in your community. So when it comes down now to the overall purpose of the application, we've talked about what the customer does. The customer will be able to be part of a community, ask questions, file complaints, get in front of constituents. But also some of the features that we want to build have to do with interruptions on a day-to-day basis. So here in Chicago, it happened to me yesterday when I just realized that the electricity is going to be down for a couple of hours. That information is published somewhere, and I'm sure there are some signs on the street, but I wasn't paying attention. All that information, all the scheduled maintenance that impacts your day-to-day life is public information. That's the type of information we want to bring in from all of these different sources so that a user who has the app will get a notification that says, hey, tomorrow between 2 p.m. and 4 p.m., you're not going to have electricity. Or we're doing some work with people's gas when it comes down to something happening on your street, whatever that is. All of this information, we want to centralize this, we want to funnel it, so on a day-to-day basis you're significantly more up to date with what's happening in a community that could impact your day-to-day life. Or the other feature that we definitely want to have as part of the application, especially at launch, is something very simple that in Chicago it's impacting pretty much all of us, which is, hey, there's going to be a street cleaning tomorrow. Move your car from the left side of the street to the right side of the street, or else you're going to get a ticket.
This is huge information. I love everything about what you're talking about. All this is very, very relevant. When I remember when I was growing up, it wasn't so much of an issue because we had a lady with binoculars who was across the street from us named Mary, who was just viewing everything that was going on and then felt it upon herself to tell everybody. Now that we're kind of a little bit like we're further away and yet closer at the same time because of technology, I feel like this is a huge necessity for anybody who anybody who's living in America. I mean, you're in a stage where suddenly now the access to information is supposed to be there, but unless you're actually looking for it, you're not really informed about the thing that's happening right in front of you or right beside you. This is an elegant solution. I love it.
And so that's what we want to build. But there's another thing that I want to talk about as a benefit of having an application like the one we're building.
Yeah.
It's also about having a two-way communication channel. The reality is, again, a lot of public officials, they're doing the right thing. They're getting all of these complaints, for example, that there's a big pothole on the street, and they fix it. But there's no way to know, hey, like, did the residents realize that, hey, I listened to them? You know, so part of the platform we're building is this ability to have a two-way communication channel where you can tell people that you've done what they asked for, where they get updated. It's such a black hole what's happening today with service requests. The reality is that you may not even get a notification that some complaint that you've lodged with your local municipality has been fixed. Or if you do, you get it by mail. I mean, it's the 21st century, and the government, by and large, is still operating in this manual fashion.
Yeah.
And ultimately, the biggest reason why I think this project is exciting is not just what it will do from a pure communication point of view. It's the artificial intelligence that we are building as an underlying layer for this citizen communication application. Because we want to actually learn literally at a user level about their preferences, about what matters to them, and we want to show them the relevant information and the relevant time. And it's a test that we're doing and a bet that we're making, wherein we really believe technology can revolutionize how citizens and local governments can interact with each other. And we want this to be there for people to see and for governments to really get faith into what technology can do for them. It's like, you know, the best example I have, analogy that I have is this. You know how you have Google Fiber?
Yes.
And it's in some cities. Google is not doing this because they want to make money. It's not profitable for them at all. They're doing the Google Fiber, the Google Fiber, for no other reason than they're trying to push the big carriers who actually have internet infrastructures like Comcast, Verizon, and et cetera, to have the same technology adopted on their end. And we're doing the same, right? I'm not trying to build this application just because I know it's going to be successful, because it will. I'm doing this because in doing so, I hope to encourage other government entities to do their own thing and implement the technologies that will really help them in their day-to-day life, which may have nothing to do with how governments and constituents interact with each other. It may have to do with operational costs. It may have to do with hiring. I don't know if you know, but the United States is the biggest employer of, it is simply put, biggest employer in the entire world. Number one employer. Can you imagine just the hurdles that have to do with how the US government deals with hiring, managing their candidates, managing their employees, HR payroll, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And what they're using is still, again, manual solutions. The reality is that artificial intelligence has already been proven to completely revolutionize how recruitment is done. The ability for a variety of AI solutions that we know of to simply screen out the candidates who are not eligible for a job has improved significantly over time. And you have, you know, the US government, biggest employer in the world. And the government doesn't have any sort of AI solutions or even predictive analytics solutions that would help them improve that process of hiring new people.
Wow. There is a lot, an immense amount of efficiency that we see that could happen from there. There's just the amount of cost reduction. You know, that money is all being utilized from somewhere, from people's budgets. That money is being utilized on inefficiencies. And from a business owner standpoint, when I look at that, I see, wow, that money could be better put to use elsewhere. And all the stress that those people are feeling, I do see the same issue with the black hole. So I love that you found a very elegant way to resolve that and have a forward-focused working way of resolving that as an issue.
Thank you. And then, you know what, like one of the most aggravating things that is happening, you know, and it's absolutely true. So the fear that the private sector has and the public sector has as well is that automation is going to reduce the number of jobs available out there, right?
Right.
That's a big thing, you know, like, hey, my job is going to disappear. And it's true. And the reality is that a lot of jobs should disappear. There are so many jobs right now that are costing us as an economy that should not exist. And that's the hard truth that most politicians cannot touch, right? You cannot talk about reducing jobs, even if they're very manual and completely antiquated. And even if they should very likely be removed, nobody wants to touch it. It's such a touchy topic to discuss. But It's the truth. Like, if we want to really...
It is strange. I want to jump in here for a moment because it is really strange that we've got so many millions of unfilled jobs and so many other millions of jobs that we shouldn't have anybody in. That there should not be a live person doing that job for a huge variety of reasons. Mm-hmm. It makes no sense to. And, you know, one natural idea is, hey, why don't we take these people who are doing this thing that... They definitely, first off, these people definitely did not go to school to do some of these super manual jobs. Like that did not happen. They couldn't find a job somewhere else, and this is the job they were offered, so they took it, and they were told they could be in this for the next 20 years and retire. And they got excited about that idea. But we could also be doing that with any of these other jobs that are already still unfilled and be stressing our infrastructure as a nation way, 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 way less. So that is something that we've talked about here before. And definitely, similar mindset. We're not afraid to say that some of these jobs shouldn't exist. That we know that. We are very well aware of that. We're glad that you see that too.
Yeah, and the reality is that, to your point, even if jobs are reduced for specific functions, you can use the same people on so many other tasks that need to be done. I mean, the reality is, for example, instead of having to wait for a decision that takes 6 months in today's government affairs, maybe that will take 1 month or 2 months if more people are relocated from a manual job to dealing with those specific issues.
Right.
And that's the one thing that a lot of people within the government space, they don't realize that it's not binary, right? The rise of technology, the adoption of emerging technologies do not necessarily need to threaten the people that exist in specific functions. They may need to be relocated. They may need to learn new skills. They may need to do other tasks. But it's not technology versus humans. It's not an either or. And that's a very difficult discussion that I have to have on a daily basis. Tomorrow I'm actually going to a conference to talk about just artificial intelligence as an enabler to day-to-day processes, because the organizers, they're bringing in 21 companies. These companies are all Fortune 500 companies, and they're concerned about how to position adoption of technology within their own organizations. And my talk is going to be just about that. It's like how technology and humans can coexist very easily, I may add, and how artificial intelligence can really make your life significantly easier as an employee and as an organization. Wow. Because that's the topic. That's the thing. Mm-hmm. Is like people are reacting to artificial intelligence in a very emotional way. And there's no emotion in AI. AI is a rule-based software which will do specific tasks better than any human can at any given moment in time. And of course, the corollary also applies where like it can do some things very poorly because it wasn't coded properly. But the reality with artificial intelligence is that in the long term, it will do things significantly better than us for things that we shouldn't be doing in the first place. And that's the key message that I have for anybody who is interested in adopting artificial intelligence, is that just think of all the ways you can optimize your current business and then figure out what is technology that can support that change. Don't think of AI as being your enemy, because it's not. That's the bottom line.
Children, it has been wonderful having you, the CEO of Digital Authority Partners, an amazing man, brilliant mind. And I love how you're focused on making sure that both technology and how the government that exists to serve us as people is actually doing exactly that. You're betting on it doing what it's supposed to do and focused on making that happen. So I want to thank you again for coming on here to We All Succeed. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.